Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me and Chris. Chris, tell us who we've got on today.
Morning, Alina. We have got Toby Purser, who is an author and a historian, who has written several books, including Raiders and Invaders, Medieval England 1042 to 1228, and The First Crusade and the Crusader States. And he's here today to talk to us about his new book, The Making of England, From Rome to Reformation. Toby, welcome to History Hack.
Thank you very much for having me on.
At least none of you made a medieval joke at the beginning of this conversation like I did and put myself into trouble.
Yet.
Yet. Actually, to be fair, we started talking about other aspects of history, and we got onto the conversation of Toby's book and the quotes that he's used and things, and then we moved on to a bit of politics and worldwide things and what I do, what Chris does. But at the end of the day, we kind of came down to this one question that we thought should be asked. I'm going to kick off with this first question. What do you mean by medieval? What is medieval?
Right, thank you. Well, how long have we got? But I'll keep it brief. The book, The Making of England, covers, well, from the fall of Roman Britain through to the Reformation, so that 1,000 years of around about 400 to 1500. So that's traditionally called the medieval period. Well, technically it means the Middle Ages. So that kind of assumes that it was the middle period. So you've got the Roman classical period of antiquity, followed by the medieval middle period, followed by what historians have called the early modern period, and then into the modern 20th century. And I guess we now live in the postmodern. However, what we were talking about was really more about the pejorative meaning of medieval, as in it seems to be a kind of connotation for all things barbaric, or all things kind of simplistic. And I wanted to start the book by examining what do we mean by medieval, and the way it's unfairly treated as a kind of simplistic dark age. We'll talk about that in a bit as well, I'm sure. This idea that after Rome, civilization collapses, everything's lost for 1,000 years, which is true to an extent, but that doesn't necessarily make it barbaric or simplistic. But there's two things there: the technical Middle Ages, which is the assumption that it follows on from classical antiquity, and the idea that in popular thinking it's kind of barbaric, you know, it's kind of Games of Thrones and, you know, Lord of the Rings, and this kind of, you know, dragons and devils and demons and, you know, knights and castles, that kind of very, very kind of simplistic image. So I hope my book goes some way to unpicking that.
Yeah, because you've got in the first chapter, you talk about other myths and phrases that get used that need to be broken down, things that we use all the time, like Dark Ages and Anglo-Saxons. But those terms are much like medieval, are overused and not correct, are they?
Yeah, again, it's very difficult to unpick that, going against that cultural trend. I kind of controversially in the book say that Anglo-Saxon is, I don't call them Anglo-Saxons, I call them the early English. Because again, the contemporaries didn't call themselves Anglo-Saxons. All these are terms that historians and teachers and popular culture has kind of labelled the past, you know, so the Anglo-Saxons, you know, the Anglo-Normans, the Tudors and so on. None of these were used by contemporary people. I mean, what do we call ourselves today? Do we call ourselves the Carolingians? You know, we call the new monarch Charles. Were we Elizabethans under Elizabeth II? You know, did people in the 8th century call themselves Anglo-Saxons? They didn't. They were Angles, they were Saxons, they were English. We have those words, but they didn't call themselves Anglo-Saxons. And of course, I certainly didn't realize that we were living in a dark age. Again, the dark ages is a later label that we put on to the past, you know, after the fall of Rome, the so-called dark ages, when Edward Gibbon, the decline of Rome, the Roman Empire, the 18th century, the kind of Enlightenment histories looked back and said, well, it's a dark age. But people living in the 6th or 7th century wouldn't necessarily have thought that. But it is difficult to unpick that. So I go against Anglo-Saxon, but I concede to Vikings, for example, which of course is about the Vikings, which kind of was a contemporary word. The Viking was a kind of raider or a pirate. But again, contemporaries called them pagans because they were pagans. They were not Christian. They were the Danes. Most of them were from Denmark. So they called them Danes and pagans. The word Viking was used much as an insult. So I've tried to unpick some of those phrases and to certainly unpick the Dark Ages when we look at the fabulous treasures of Sutton Hoo and the Staffordshire Hoard, the artwork and the intellectual production of the 6th and 7th century was anything but barbaric or dark.
So I've just got to say, Chris wrote these questions and I'm reading the next one and I'm trying not to laugh as I read this because the way it's phrased is just, it's just brilliant. So I'm going to read it as it's written, because you'll all hear it in a second. Right, so when the Roman period ended, the whole Roman populace didn't just up and leave. What happened to those that stayed and the local citizens?
What's wrong with that?
That's brilliant.
That's a great question.
I think it's a fantastic, I just love the way it's phrased. They didn't just up and leave. I just think it's just absolutely brilliant. That's why I'm trying not to laugh, because I just find it great.
It is fair enough, because again, the simplest view we have of the past, you know, when we label people, the Tudors, the Stuarts, the Georgians, you know, the horrible histories kind of version of the past, which is parodies actually the popular understanding. So what happened? Did the Romans just leave? Well, actually, they did actually, in a sense, they did up and leave. The last troops were withdrawn in about 407, and the administration kind of left, the civil service did kind of leave. And a lot of the skill set left as well, and that's what people don't kind of focus on, that the skills for smelting and building, well, it wasn't just a supply chain that collapsed, which we kind of had a flavour of that in 2020 in our own current era, but the skill set also withdrew. So the skilled people left with the administration. So there was that sense of collapse. And within 30 years, the urban mechanisms of the taxation, the buildings, the baths, the public works had declined and collapsed very, very quickly. So yes, there was that sense that people did leave. But again, if you were Romano British, a citizen of Bath or Cirencester, London, which is a vast city, the biggest city outside Rome, you kind of carried on as best you could. You didn't suddenly think, oh no, I'm going to be an Anglo-Saxon now, so I better wear a different costume. You carried on. You didn't know that this was going to be the case. So it is a fair question in the sense that they did kind of go and took with them that expertise, but the majority of people remained, of course, and tried to carry on as best they could.
Yeah, it's something I've been trying to explain to my kids while they've been doing their history. Like, you don't go to bed a Tudor one night and wake up in the morning and a Stuart with a big floppy hat and a beard. It's more of a gradual thing.
Absolutely, it's a label that we put on the past. You know, that the end of the Middle Ages, after the Battle of Bosworth, you know, 22nd of August, you know, Henry the Seventh becomes king, and suddenly we're all Tudors. Absolutely not. These are artificial boundaries. But certainly in Britain in the early 5th century, there was a very dramatic collapse of the administration and the, you know, taxation, legal situation of the skill set did collapse very rapidly.
But the same is true for the Germanic tribes. The archaeology reveals it's a complex story of integration. It's not just like a simple invasion when the Jutes and the Angles and the Saxons come over. It's It's not like, say, the Norman invasion of 1066, where they come in, everything changes. The Germanic tribes, it's more of a gradual sneaking process, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this, again, this is the popular view, which has come down. Actually, Bede is guilty of much of this. Bede was a monk writing the early 8th century up in Northumberland, and he wrote the first History of England, which is an extraordinary piece of work and did draw upon recent history. But when it comes to the 5th century, he made it all up. He literally made it up, because we only have one written source of the whole 200-year period by a monk called Gildas, writing in around about 550. And his information is fairly obscure. So Bede came along and kind of decided to impose his chronology on what had happened. And he said that in 449, exactly in 449, you know, the Anglo-Saxons arrived. It's a bit like D-Day in reverse. They all kind of splashed ashore at Thanet and Kent with their kind of winged helmets. And they all arrived, and it was the beginning of the Anglo-Saxon era, which is absolute nonsense. So the archaeology, as you say, now tells us that the migrations occurred over, you know, 100, 200 years. And actually, recent research just come out after my book was finished has demonstrated even possibly over 400 years. The waves of migration, mainly from Denmark, northern Germany, arriving on boats, you know, and starting before the Romans left as well in the late 4th century, as they were brought in as mercenary troops and warriors who initially were given kind of citizenship. And then after the collapse, they start to arrive in much bigger numbers. So it's a very gradual migration period that over 100, 150 years.
So slowly England and the English begin to replace the Britons. How was the arrival of Christianity? Oh, the arrival of Christianity, that changes everything. And the rise of the English kingdoms like Mercia affect all of this?
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, again, the replacement theory kind of, again, Bede would have us think that these Anglo-Saxons all arrived and in great numbers, and they kind of exterminated the natives and replaced them. Again, it's a very, very, you know, when we're talking about a genocide earlier on. And exactly, in fact, Bede does use the word exterminate. He does use that word, disappear. And so the popular view was the Anglo-Saxons were the kind of master race. And in fact, archaeology shows that they were on average 1 inch taller, and they, from cemetery evidence, and they did have, you know, better weapons, and they had longer swords and stronger swords. So they were physically better equipped. However, the DNA evidence suggests that only up to about 30-40% of the kind of migrants were English, and most heavily settling in Norfolk, Suffolk, Kent, the east of England. So what happened to everybody else? I mean, were they literally exterminated? Probably not. I mean, exterminate can also mean to drive away. So what I propose is that the British either migrated west to what is now Cornwall, into Wales, or even into Brittany. We know there were migrations out of Britain into what is now Brittany in France, hence Brittany. Or they were enslaved. This is a very unsavory aspect of the kind of English nation. So they did have slaves. Slavery was very common. Obviously, in the Roman Empire, it carried on. And so the Brittonic people were very likely enslaved by the new elite minority, or they were possibly killed in there were battles between British tribes, of course. The Gildas talks a lot about the British fighting the British, and the Anglo-Saxons tribes were kind of divide and rule and establishing their own kingdom. So by around about 600 AD, when Augustine comes from Rome to convert the pagan English, you've got a patchwork of little kingdoms, you know, Kent, Sussex, Wessex, and and so on. We've also got a lot of British, most of the population is British in terms of the kind of DNA. And you've also got British kingdoms that have survived in various pockets here and there. And of course, most obviously in Wales. And in fact, the actual word Wales is an old English word, Wenas, which actually means slave. So what happens to the English people is that they actually become slaves in their own country. So the English elite turn up and, you know, take control and enslave them. And so Wenas is an old English word for slave, which becomes the word Welsh. So Wales was actually the place of the slaves. Cornwall was heavily populated by the British, who also was known as slaves. So slave and Welsh and British is synonymous. So that holds right through to Domesday Book in 1086. So the highest slave population, because England remained a slave population, well into the 12th century, 20% of the population of Cornwall in 1086 were slaves. So it's the highest, whereas on average 10% of the population was slaves. Cornwall has the highest density of slaves. It's a direct direct consequence of the English kind of conquest and migrations of the 7th and 8th century. And even the early law codes of King Ini of Wessex, around about the 690s, has a clause for the English and a clause for the Welsh, the British, the slave. So there's two, it's an apartheid. It's a legal apartheid. So the British, the Welsh, if they commit theft or adultery or fornication, they could be executed or castrated, whereas the English have to pay the Wehrgeld, the price, the financial cost. So, you know, if you're a slave, you'll get castrated for rape. If you're English, you'll get a fine. So we've even got a legal apartheid going on there as well.
And then just as things seem to be settling down with the English, the Norse turn up and they bring Englishness to sort of the brink of extinction. But how's this saved by, I go back to my degree and I hated Asser's Life of Alfred, but I'm going to say, how did King Alfred and his children and successors then help defeat the Norse and reverse this?
Yes, I mean, they are the English, the kind of manifest destiny of the English master races. I like to see themselves, as even Bede talks about that. By the arrival of the Vikings in the late 8th century, by this time we've got an established network of English kingdoms, Wessex, Northumberland, Mercia, and so on. The English-British genetic social divide is much more blurred, but you have a patchwork of English elite kings. And the Viking arrival is devastating. It is the greatest existential threat to this English network. It's very important to say that there's no such thing as England. By the time of King Alfred, what you've got is a patchwork of kingdoms. So there's a king of Wessex, there's a king of Northumbria, there's a king of Mercia. There's no such thing as England. They do talk about Britain, which is a kind of Romano-Roman legacy. They do talk about the king of all Britain. There's no such thing as of England until the arrival of the Vikings, and the Vikings wipe out all of the other English kingdoms. And really, the Vikings are the kind of shock doctrine that in a sense, makes England, because the only English kingdom left is Wessex. All the other kings have been slaughtered. It's total collapse. The Vikings have settled in Repton in the winter of 866. The great army under Guthrum. Alfred is the last one left. It's a real 1940 moment, you know. But of course, Alfred also, like Winston Churchill, not only was at the heart of history, but he actually wrote the history as well, because the first Anglo-Saxon chronicles were commissioned by Alfred. in 893. So he decided he knew that the pen was mightier than the sword, that he did defeat the Vikings in battle, but he also knew that to win the war, you'd have to win it through literacy, learning, the backup of Rome. It wasn't just good enough to win one battle, which he does in 878, a crucial battle. So he's nearly captured in Chippenham as a kind of 12 days of Christmas when the Christian feast, and the Vikings know this, the dastardly Vikings cheat because they're pagan, so they know they can catch him napping, having his turkey and so on. And they nearly caught him at Chippenham. So he escaped with a band of brothers. It's very Shakespearean, it's very Churchillian, into the marshes in Athelney, the Somerset Levels, which at that time were totally flooded, as they probably will be in about 30 years' time again. So and these various places like Glastonbury, Tor, and so on, he hides out in the marshes, we don't know, maybe 100 or so men. And he manages to regroup and fights a battle at Edington and defeated Guthrum comprehensively in battle. But instead of executing Guthrum, he baptised him. It's a stroke of genius. If he'd executed Guthrum, there would have been a kind of martyrdom of the Viking leader. But he baptised him, which is the ultimate kind of humiliation, becomes his godfather. And so the next 10 years, re-educating the English and really spreading the word of the Anglican, the English people. Still not England, but it's all about survival and consolidation with the kind of fortified towns in Winchester and Wantage and Wareham and so on. And the Danelaw, the kind of the Iron Curtain, as it were, of the late 8th century, the division between the Danish territory. But it's not England yet, but the Viking invasions create that vacuum. And it's Alfred's daughter, Ethelfled, and his son, Edward, who go on to take over the Danish territories in Mercia and the north. And his grandson, Athelstan, declares in 927, he declares this new kingdom of England. And that is only possible because of the Viking, invasions of the late 8th century that create the vacuum with Alfred's survival and the kind of reconquest of his son, daughter, and grandson. Yes, it's a great story. It's a story written mainly by Alfred, and he does rewrite the past. He makes out that he was the only one left, and we actually know that there's archaeological evidence, coin evidence, that he had an alliance with the king of Mercia, Kenwulf. But in the Chronicle, Kenwulf is written off as a foolish thane. So he's deliberately kind of creating, bit like 1940. He stood alone and he did it all by himself. And his achievement was that much greater. But having said that, it was undoubtedly an extraordinary achievement of survival.
So then comes the Norman invasion, 1066, a date that I know. Was it more devastating than the Norse invasion?
Yes and no, because the interesting point about 1066 is that the reason why England is conquered is because it is a nation state. Now, this is something of a paradox. In fact, the more civilized a state is, the more defined its borders, the more intact there is something to conquer, if you see what I mean. So, people would argue, it was conquered because it was weak and vulnerable and the Saxons were too busy drinking beer. But it's the quite opposite. Again, back to 1940, Nazi Germany conquered France in 6 weeks. It can be done. You can conquer an entire state very quickly. So the irony of 1066 is you've actually got a very sophisticated civilized nation state that is totally intact with laws, boundaries, rules, regulations, and it has been conquered before, don't forget, under King Canute in 1016. Canute, of course, the Danish invasions finally do break through. They're Christian this time, and England is conquered in 1016. And there's a big battle at Ashingdon in Essex, which kind of wipes out most of the English elite. He governs till 1035. So the old English monarchy only returns by mistake, by accident, under Edward the Confessor, and he has a succession crisis. So William the Conqueror invades in 1066. So there's a precedent for this total conquest of England. It's happened 50 years before. So in that sense, it's a regime change from the Anglo-Saxon elite to the Norman elite. The Kingdom of England is left intact. It has now reached maturity. It's a state, and Doomsday Book, which is of course made 20 years later, is actually evidence not just of the Norman conquest, but evidence of the, you know, sophistication of the late English state. Well, having said that, the devastation was immense in terms of Yorkshire, particularly the north was devastated by William deliberately, and actually it took centuries for the north to recover economically, because it's always seen as slightly separate to the south, the north-south divide that is still with us today. All Anglo-Saxon churches nearly all were destroyed, pulled down, cathedrals was destroyed. Castles were built, demolishing vast areas of urban locations. In Lincoln, Oxford, for example, half the town was destroyed to build castles. So that there was devastation, but the regime change was so total, and everything else carried on, the laws, the custom, the taxation system. Because William realised what he'd got was a highly sophisticated, extremely wealthy nation state that he could just, you know, continue, and he was crowned in the age-old fashion in Westminster Abbey, as Harold had been before him, and so on, because he wanted to see himself very much as a, you know, an English king as well.
In 1215, what sets England onto a separate path to the other European kingdoms?
Well, the Norman conquest, as I say, kind of retained that English nation state that had developed in the 10th, 11th century, but replaced it entirely with this Anglo-Norman elite. One of the things that happens in 1066 is that England is brought into the European as a kind of Brentry, not a Brexit, as a Brentry. And in 1066, we're brought into the continent because so many of the Norman lords, including William, of course, who was Duke of Normandy. So many Norman landowners had land in England and in Normandy. So it's very much a kind of cosmopolitan Anglo-Norman political state. Now, fast forward 100 years to William's descendant, King John. John's got a problem because by 1200 or so, the connections between England and Normandy are much weaker. And so the English elite, who are French, of course, they're not actually English, the English aristocrats have less concern with the French possessions. But John, of course, was a French king, is born in central France and in Anjou, and sees that as his family patrimony. And in 1204, that's all lost. You know, the King of France, Philip, conquers Normandy and vast swathes. So John spends 10 years trying to get it back, scheming and plotting and taxing and exacting very unfair tolls from the barons. By the time we get to 1214, there's a rebellion, and it leads to the Great Charter, essentially was a rebellion of the aristocrats who were fed up with John telling them what to do. And he shut down the law courts, and he'd abused their wives, and he'd executed his own nephew. So he was a tyrant. He was very much a tyrannical king. So a lot of personal issues there. But in the Great Charter, they say that, look, you know, you cannot govern by yourself. You'll have to be kind of guided by a council of 25. You can no longer govern by yourself because you are completely out of control. So that's quite revolutionary. Although the first Magna Carta was torn up, the one that was witnessed in June 1215 was the Pope annulled it. John died the following year, and it's reissued in 1217 without the kind of council of the 25 who were going to look after the king, because you've got a different king 9-year-old boy, Henry III, and he got different problems. But the principle of kingship by consent has now been established. And again, that's not new in Magna Carta. We do see it before various occasions and in the last 100 or so years, but it's now written into this very powerful document that's reissued in 1225. And from that, we get the first parliaments in the 1230s and 40s. And by 1300, under John's grandson, Edward I, Magna Carta has become part of the legal cornerstones. And it's referred to and quoted by judges, jurors, you know, great barons. They always wavered at the king and say, you can't have huge amounts of money to go back into France and Wales and Scotland, because it says here you've got to get consent of the people. So that sets England, it does set England a very different path. And there are similar documents in the early 13th century in Spain and in Hungary. There are kind of similar intellectual movements against tyrannical kings, but England does settle a different path, not just because of Magna Carta, but because the Parliament, which is a kind of representation, not just of the great barons, but look at the next level down of the local gentry from the shires, which makes England quite special.
So the Middle Ages, they're quite, it's quite crazy, really, in the Middle Ages. You've got conquests of Edward I, you've got the plague, you've got peasant revolts. How did the English actually weather all of these storms?
Well, you say it's crazy, but the last 10 years have been pretty crazy in our own world as well. I think we've just been through a pandemic recently, and it might give us a bit of sympathy as to what it was like in the 1350s with the Black Death, you know, which obviously the mortality rate was 50%, but people responded the same way we did in 2020. They went into lockdown, they went into quarantine because there was no cure, no prevention. Again, we've got to be careful of thinking, oh yes, we're back to the medieval pejorative, it was barbaric and terrible. You know, it was in the early 14th century, there's no doubt, economically. We went into a kind of mini ice age. The temperature dropped, and the weather, you know, they went through climate change. The harvests were terribly bad for decades. There were sort of cattle crop failures across Europe, and tens of millions died. You know, so it's like what we call a harvest sensitive economy. In other words, if there's a bad harvest, you'd starve, you die. There's no surplus. The population of England is about 5 million and is overpopulated, and we're not producing enough food. So the early 14th century really was a terrible time. And we even think in this century that the average height dropped by an inch or two on average. It didn't recover until the 18th century, because the average height before that was about 5'6" or 5'7", not far off what it is today. But the 14th century was such a terrible time of economic climate change, pandemic, and these are lessons for our own time. Of course, living through, you know, maybe people will say in 100 years time, how do they cope in 2020 2021? So we have a little bit of sympathy about how did people cope, and it was incredibly tough times in the middle 14th century particularly.
So skipping ahead a bit, because we don't want to give away your whole book, we want people to buy it, so we're going to move on to Henry VIII, Reformation. Could the Reformation and the be seen as casting off of the last vestiges of Roman control and the establishment of a purely English establishment in the form of the Church of England?
Yes, I think, I mean, my book is From Rome to Reformation. So the narrative of the book is framed between the departure of Rome in the early 5th century, the legacy, the power that Rome has throughout the Middle Ages. And finally, that first Brexit, if you like, of 1536, the Reformation. I mean, it really is one of those transcendent episodes in English, even world history. You know, it's very quick. It's very sudden. Henry VIII with Cromwell, of course. They shut down a monastery. They break with Rome. And within 3 or 4 years, all of the medieval monasteries have been pulled down, destroyed. And it is a sense of the last control that Rome has over England. Although England's been a nation state since the 10th, 11th century, all the monarchs have essentially paid homage to the Pope, so that there's a higher authority, and of course the church, the clergy, the archbishops answer to the Pope. And you know, there's a sense of English exceptionalism, you know, where the English are always going to throw off papal Catholic authority. It used to be thought that there was that kind of building, you know, overthrow going back to the Lollards in the 14th century and the kind of heretics. But actually, recent thinking is that we were a very Catholic country well into the 1500s, where we're building new church towers and donating, you know, vast amounts of money to churches and monasteries well into the 1520s and 30s. So in terms of the popular belief, we might be anti-papal, and we were very suspicious of foreigners as well. There's all sorts of endless reports that throughout the late Middle Ages of this dislike of foreigners, the Flemings, the Italians, and so on, which seems to be a thing in English history. We'd already expelled all the Jews in 1290, and it's extraordinary. Anti-Semitism, we would obviously call it today. In fact, the first mention of Holocaustum is in English Chronicle, that the Jews of York were all slaughtered in the 1180s. And Rome had extracted every last penny out of them and even made them wear a badge, which has chilling repercussions into the modern history. We expelled all the Jews in 1290. So we've got a kind of track record here of disliking, hating foreigners. We've made war on the French for 100 years. It's the English pastime. However, that doesn't necessarily make England anti-Rome. It's a deeply Catholic, deeply devout society. So well into the 1520s and 30s. So it comes down to Henry VIII. It comes down to the extraordinary power that he had with new treason laws. And basically, if you didn't swear the oath of allegiance to him, you were executed. So the abbot of Glastonbury was hanged in his own abbey, you know, for not swearing allegiance. So, and the destruction was massive. The whole libraries were burnt down, and manuscripts were thrown into the rivers. Gold plate stolen, melted, stained glass windows smashed. About 95% of medieval English art and artifacts were destroyed. And it's extraordinary, you know, orgy of violence in this period, 1536 to about 1540. But it's a top-down political, act. And of course, you know, it's carried out with the support of the aristocracy, who thought, well, actually, we should get ourselves a nice monastery out of this and turn it into a country house. And so a lot of them are given the property, or they buy it from the king. And, you know, so it's not all the king himself, but it's the elite are making this happen. And they were still Catholic, didn't see anything wrong with kind of plundering and pillaging a monastery, and still died Catholics, as Henry VIII did himself. But it was an extraordinary episode that was a fundamental break with Rome.
Toby, this has been brilliant, fantastic. We're always lacking a bit of medieval on this podcast, so you have filled a nice little gap. Feel free to come and join us again. If you've got a new book out, or you fancy just talking about something completely and utterly random to do with the medieval period, you are very welcome to come back and have a chat with us.
Thank you very much. I hope I managed to, you know, I brought your Holocaust in a bit there, and brought in the connections with the 20th century, and, you know, might make people think that medieval, you know, the connections today are all there. The first Holocaust, the first expulsion of the Jews. And the Jews didn't return to England until the 17th century.
Well, let's get you back on to talk about that with us, because that would be a very interesting podcast, something that we haven't really talked about. But do remind our listeners where they can get your book and the title of it.
Okay, the book is called The Making of England, From Rome to Reformation. It's published by Amberley Press. It's out on public release on the 15th of November. You'll be able to buy it on usual online outlets and in hopefully on the high street bookshops after 15th. Lovely hardback with some lovely colour photos, and I'm very pleased with the product.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.